Welcome to the last of our eight episodes into the season two of Doctor Who's bi-regeneration phase, I guess. This is not the podcast that was planned. We were going to go with John Kenneth Muir again, and he was unable.
A proper guest.
I wasn't saying a proper guest. I was saying a scheduled guest. Because I wanted a scheduled guest who wanted to be here rather than an unscheduled guest who is reluctant and slightly prickly to at 10:37 to be doing a podcast. But I do, by good fortune, have Magnus in my vicinity. So we are literally in the same room. So apologize for the sort of echoey quality you'll get to this, but it's not a room that we plan to record in. But I couldn't not take the opportunity to have I guess for the last episode, no matter how prickly they might be about being here.
And being held hostage.
She's being held hostage, you hear that? Held hostage. So yes, we've just literally finished the last episode, The Reality War. Magnus didn't see last week, obviously saw the Interstellar song contest because we recorded that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'm always very happy to be chatting to Magnus, hence they are in my space at this moment. Not many people come into my space. I don't like them in my space. And quite honestly, most people don't want to be in my space either.
Hostage.
Hostage, exactly. So we're not going to go on for massively long on this because, as I said, it's almost 11 o'clock at night, but we wanted to record something. And given also Magnus might be slightly more prickly slash feel hostage because I have made her watch the episode as well. That face that you can't see is not good. But I don't think that's about the episode. That's about me making them watch it. So I'm just going to go straight to it. You didn't see last week's episode. We did have a quick talk about it. There was zero recap, which surprised me.
Yeah. So, I mean, it felt like they were wrapping a lot of things. A lot of things happening in this episode.
Because it's weird, because in a way, when you came on to sort of help do some of these podcasts with me was pretty much the start of his era.
Yeah.
And so you've kind of followed through.
We watched the episode, The Giggle.
By Regenerated. And
I think we watched, did we watch the first one?
Yeah, we watched the Christmas one because I remember you were reluctant to that as well. I remember the different colours of reluctance so clearly.
I'm a spectrum of reluctance.
You are a spectrum of reluctance, which is normally the mantle I would take for myself, but somehow in this dynamic, I utterly lose it.
Magnus wins every time.
It does seem that way. So yeah, again, did you? I found it,
you said, and I quote, wow, this episode really does somehow keep going.
Yeah, I think to be specific, I said, it just keeps wobbling on.
That's it, keep wobbling on, which I thought was a little harsh.
It did feel like you just didn't know quite where in the episode structure you were. It just kind of wobbled onwards towards the end.
It didn't have the structure I was expecting.
No, same here.
I was expecting the crescendo to be the death of the Rani.
Yeah, yeah. And they nixed that pretty quickly. And I sort of felt, I mean, again, I don't know their contracts. They kind of nixed the wrong Rani. I mean, I like Anita Dobson. I think she's great. But
the other Rani was really cool and really evil.
I liked it, yeah.
And suave.
It was a very Kate O'Mara, the original Rani, sort of vibe to it. Very, very over the top, but powerful and somehow authentic at the same time. And
unrepentant.
And unrepentant. And they did go for the Rani, which was a question I think we might have talked about on the song contest about whether she would just be another master. But they did put this thing about her not being evil, but more immoral and just purely interested in sort of
immoral.
Did I say immoral? I think I did, didn't I? Amoral. And just interested in the experiment and in the process.
Indifferent to pain and suffering.
Yes, to quote the episode, absolutely. But yeah, it felt, I mean, it was written by Russell T. Davis, it felt like it was written by Russell T. Davies. It felt very much like one of his finales, the way, as you said, it brings the whole two seasons together to a point where I'd rather it didn't. It didn't feel like it needed to in a lot of ways.
I needed it.
Did you?
Yeah, because I didn't know what else was happening. I liked it. It definitely felt like it's the end of an era finale. So that was useful for me. It wraps up a lot of the themes that might not be continued in a future season because it might have a different tone and a different focus. The focus of this era seems to be love.
Because John Muir last week was saying that the notion that television is written these days on the idea that the people watching it are kind of, to use the term again, by watching it, in the sense that they are watching their phones, reading their phones and watching a show. So the writers are kind of aware that there's almost like a flow to allow people to still stay in there, but also being aware that they're probably also flicking through their phones. I kind of noticed you weren't really flicking through your phones. You had your phone in hand.
I was enraptured.
You were watching it.
So I didn't have my phone in hand. It was on the table.
Oh, it was initially in your hand, and then you must have moved it to the table.
When it started.
Yeah, okay. Okay, well, I was like, okay, did your show one over the phone is my point. Because if you're not that much connected, one, whoever you are, I tend to move towards my phone. And
I started reluctant, but it did enthrall me.
Oh, that's good. So what enthralled you? What sort of bits, especially since you didn't see last week?
I feel like the script is good, and the characterizations are really strong, and the Rani, especially the Doctor, are really, really charismatic. And yeah, I just really enjoyed it. I thought the Bone Beasts were amazing. I thought the Wish Baby and Conrad, I didn't know who Conrad was, but that's fine. I thought it was interesting. They had loads of really cool elements in it. I thought the Mad God was great. I thought him being forced back into hell with his weird supernova,
which they've been using in each episode that we've been to build up.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah.
They mentioned it in the episode before, but by doing so, it's build up all this energy, which then the Rani uses in
The idea of realities pressing together, creating friction was interesting. And the Rani's motivations are just make sense to that character. And yeah.
Because Omega in the previous show, you know, not in the 20th century version, was always a very theatrical sort of Royal Shakespeare company, you know, baddie, lost character as such.
So he's been in it a lot before?
He was in two stories. He was in one with John Pertwee, and then he was in one with Peter Davison. And there's been audio plays since then that's used the character too. But in terms of the TV show, there were two episodes. And again, being the 70s and 80s, very sort of British thespic playing of the character. So this is quite a reversal from the ability to enunciate, to, you know, growl and hiss, I guess. But that worked for you. I mean, I was fine with it.
I too was sad that the quote-unquote wrong Rani was eaten.
Well, yeah, I mean, the other Rani's fine. Mrs. Flood is interesting.
We've seen a lot of her.
We've seen a lot of her, and she's not really the Rani. The Rani is very much as the Rani was being played in this episode. It was a shame to see that go. I did enjoy Jodie Whittaker popping up to do a little bit. Oh, that was cute. And I thought they played off each other well. I thought that was nice. I was surprised that we didn't get to see Susan again, the granddaughter, which we saw in those little flashes in the song contest.
Their presence seems to have no relevance.
I mean, it was meant to be relevant for the moment that he's in that episode, he's floating in space near death, and the visions of his granddaughter propel him, and that and a glitter canister propel him back to the
confetti cannon.
Confetti cannon, yes. But ultimately, long term, you think as soon as you have a bit of a stunt guest star appearing like that, you feel it's going to, especially when this episode is dealing with a daughter, you would think, well, maybe the
These things
granddaughter
must be
connected.
connected,
Yeah.
but they are
And they're
not.
not. So that was vaguely disappointing. And it felt like the bit where at the end, when he's at Belinda's house dealing with Poppy, seemed to go on quite a long time and seemed a little, I don't know, the pacing there just seemed a bit off to me. It was almost the point where I'm watching, like, okay, we've just introduced the fact that he's about to regenerate. And
I also feel a bit sorry for Belinda.
yeah, how so?
Well, based on this reality, wish reality that they were in, only for a day, everything about her existence has changed
Yeah.
without her consent or her knowledge, changed her entire reality.
Yeah, it's funny in
It's
a way.
like you're a mother now to this child, and also this person was the father. Like,
It's almost like one wish has been replaced by another when the previous
his
episode.
wish.
Yeah, so I mean, initially Conrad's wish that she was in a relationship with a doctor or John Smith and have a baby called Poppy in the previous episode. And as you say, in this episode, rather than being freed from the chains of wishes, she's kind of reconfigured into a different person's wish, which suits the story. And obviously, she's very happy in the moment, but it is, as you say, a
Well, she
kind of
could be because
non-consensual rewrite. Yeah.
her memories have
Yeah.
been,
Yeah.
everything about her life has been rewritten.
So it'd been interesting if you'd had Belinda from episode six, say, and Belinda at the end of this episode come together, and to see whether Belinda from episode six would have been happy knowing that in the future that she'd have been rewritten to have a child and a husband, because we never know whether that Belinda would have really wanted
Not a
that.
husband.
Is it not a husband boyfriend, is it?
They're not together.
Oh, does it say that? I missed that.
They co-parent, I
They
guess.
co-parent.
That's why her parents look after Poppy.
Gotcha,
He's the
yes.
ninth.
Yes, I think
He
I was
leaves.
slowly fading out of my focus on it at that point. But even so, you've still got that question that, as you say, the Belinda with Poppy is very happy with that existence, but we never really know whether the Belinda, I suppose you could argue the Belinda in between, sort of midway through this episode, when she knows it was a wish, she still is very protective of Poppy, that she goes into the zero room.
Well, she's
So,
protective because she remembers Poppy being her daughter
yeah. So
still.
it's still the same issue.
I quite liked Ruby's involvement in the episode.
Yeah. I thought that was nice. Yeah.
I think it was nice for her to be the one who remembers and pushes for, like, no, there was a purpose for this part of the plan that we did. There was a child. The child is gone. That's important. You need to remember. Yeah,
Yeah, no,
I
I.
did get it did feel a bit like, wow, this is a room full of mostly women who have been utterly charmed by the doctor. It seemed a bit unfair. I didn't watch the Christmas one with Anita,
Yeah.
but it felt very much like, oh yeah, I like popped around in time looking for you, seeing how you were doing. But after I saw you dancing with your boyfriend, I immediately went to find someone else and I got pregnant.
Yeah, that
That's
was.
kind of how that is. I felt like that was played.
I mean, it's a lovely. The Christmas episode is a lovely episode, which we've never reviewed for this.
Why not?
Well, in part, I was trying to get you to, but you were very busy at the time.
Christmas was.
Christmas was crazy for very good reasons. So I didn't
I
read
don't need
up.
a good reason. Listener, I don't need a good reason.
Well, there we go. But she did have a good reason. There was a good reason why you did. But anyway, the point being, yeah, it didn't happen. So I didn't end up reviewing it. But it is a really nice episode. I mean, we can. Do you want to know about that, or do you think you'll want to watch it yourself?
About it, there's a time hotel.
It's a time hotel, but there's a sort of secondary story where the doctor's kind of locked out of that and meets a person, meets Anita, and they just, it's like a period of time where they just get to know each other. And it's just a very nice story of two people.
Seems like he's getting to know a lot of
It
people.
does feel that way. I never got the impression that she thought that he was sort of heterosexual and potentially interested, but Maybe I'm misremembering it since.
I don't know. It seems like a lot. I don't know. This episode did make me kind of think that he does just walk around the universe, love bombing people and then vanishing.
Doesn't the Rani say that you're all a bit like insects or play toys or a fetish to him?
I thought their words were very incisive.
There was certainly a feeling of, yeah, that might cut deep there. But yeah, I mean, I thought it was okay. I thought the ending, I suppose, got to quickly mention the ending.
I think that, well, I think the whole episode, I think it was a good finale for an era.
Yes, it did feel like it wasn't a finale, wasn't it?
Yeah. I'm sad that Rogue wasn't in it, and I'm sad that I missed a one last week where there was a brief Rogue appearance.
But it's on iPlayer.
Moments passed. I think Enshuti and I can't remember what the name of the actor is. I think they would have made a really cool pair to run around the universe.
Yeah, no.
Missed opportunity.
Maybe a missed opportunity, absolutely. So what did you think about the regeneration at the end?
Oh my God, Billy Piper. Billy Piper was my era.
Yeah.
Yes.
So this is something you're proud. I mean, because I don't know what to feel about it. I heard a rumor about it going around the papers this last couple of weeks. I didn't put much stock in it. At the same time, it did feel like something I could imagine Davis doing. And it does make sense within the character, since Rose had a massive impact on the character. That
I was shocked.
You were shocked, yeah, because we hadn't mentioned it. So
you felt for certain it would be a white man.
I thought they were just going to go out on him regenerating.
Yeah, that was the main thing that I thought would happen, because I just hadn't heard anything about who would be the next Doctor, so I just assumed that they hadn't chosen anyone yet.
Well, there hadn't been really much about Gatwa leaving. There'd been rumours and, you know, inner circles sort of saying, yeah, he's positioning to America.
His star is rising,
and there have been reshoots, but there was no sort of press that I saw that talked about this being potentially happening.
It's interesting, because is this the first time the Doctor has willingly, well, deliberately taken his own life? Or
that's a good question.
Willingly? With deliberate purpose?
With deliberate purpose. I'm just going back. There must be one, I suppose. So who was Tennant didn't, because he was, the last Tennant was shot by the toy maker. Well, you saw that with the more recent David Tennant, the giggle.
Yeah, but he's not dead, is he?
No, but he's not dead. I'm just thinking about the act of potential sacrifice.
I see.
Regeneration. But he didn't. Jodie Whittaker's didn't.
Matt Smith?
Capaldi's didn't. Matt Smith was growing old and held to a portent that he was going to die anyway, so he didn't. Old Tennant didn't. He went and saved Wilf in his last act in End of Time. Eccleston, I suppose Eccleston kind of did, because he does that kiss with Billy Piper, sucking out the time vortex out of her.
I don't remember this. I remember him becoming Tennant.
Yeah, he does that, and he's, because she had all the time energy in her, and he sucks it out of her in a very weird way, and then says that that's damaged him. But so assumedly he knew that that was the outcome of that. So I suppose Eccleston did. I don't think McGann's was injured, so he didn't. McCoy's was shot, so he didn't. Colin Baker was fired and didn't appear, and they had Sylvester McCoy in a wig on the floor, the TARDIS regenerating. No explanation why he regenerated.
Why was he fired?
It was a time of turmoil. It was a time where the BBC and Doctor Who was at loggerheads as to its viability.
Interesting.
And shots were fired, and they wanted him to go. And it was a very unhappy exit for Colin. Yeah. Had a very bad time on the show in terms of stories and the BBC, but his done great stuff in the audio plays since. It's become very popular, which is great. Nice to have that sort of redemption arc. Peter Davison's does. He sacrifices. He gives his companion a vial of antidote. They're both dying of a disease, of a poison, and he gives it to his companion rather than taking any of himself. So he risks death with that. Baker was aware of his death coming up, but didn't actually sacrifice himself. Nor did Pertwee, really. Troughton was forced, and Hartnell got old. So yeah. So there's only two then, really. I think we could sort of two, three, maybe.
I mean, if he's being self-sacrificing versus actively forcing your own death, is that same ballpark?
It's the same ballpark, but it does feel different. I know what you mean.
There's an intentionality.
Yeah, there's a sort of premeditatedness rather than in the other instances where it's kind of the moment, having to make a decision. Of sacrifice. Here it was like actually coming and creating a scenario where the only way it would work is through your scenario and then performing it, almost more ritualized. So yeah, I think it was unusually different like that. I really like Gower. I thought he was just such a cool, beautiful, powerful presence on screen.
Some might say too powerful.
He certainly
absolutely wrecking hearts all over the place,
which is probably why he's been sucked into America, into Hollywood, I suspect. Yeah. But so yeah, he only did the two seasons, but I think certainly this season has been good, and he's given it his all, and I think he's been his own doctor, done his own thing. I mean, Billy Piper as Rose makes sense
I was very confused because I was like, but Rose is a different person, a person who was not the doctor. How can the doctor be Rose? And you very insightfully said, I think perhaps the doctor is just using Rose's face. I'm like, that would make more sense.
I mean, it's happened before.
What?
Capaldi's doctor suggests that because Capaldi played a smaller part in Fires of Pompeii with David Tennant and Catherine Tate, as one of the Romans in that, there's a suggestion, a very, very throwaway line suggestion, that he's taken that face for a reason, to remind himself to be good, to be compassionate, and to actually, it's kind of a dodgy line. And obviously, we've obviously had the most recent Tennant, which kind of took his own face again. The giggle era Tennant is kind of, so I suppose in the sense there's this idea of borrowing for various reasons. I don't know. I know as much as you do. But I think it's an interesting play. I think it's an interesting play. I think especially since the show is very aware that especially this new Davis era, I think probably scores better with younger people than slightly older people. And yet Rose kind of, Piper calls back to that crowd that might have left the show, especially since new Tennant left again. So
I would be keen to watch her as the Doctor.
I'm interested to see where it goes. And it sounds like from the tabloids are suggesting that the BBC have said, yes, they would go on and do another season without Disney, if Disney says no. So it does certainly feel like it doesn't feel like it's a moment where they're pausing the show and seeing what happens. It feels like very deliberate tease into keeping the show going. And I don't think, I'd be surprised if Piper would have done it otherwise. It was certainly an interesting ending. It wasn't one I was expecting, and I wasn't really expecting, I thought Gower was going to, but because there'd been no news and the story didn't do its usual, as you sort of say, moment where there's a sacrifice, where he's hit by energy or something, and by the end of it he's kind of fine until he makes that decision.
Yes, very deliberate, very sort of operationalized.
I also liked, it's a small thing, I like the effects of him sort of pulling out the regeneration, teasing it out by pulling his fists into.
That was fun.
Yeah, I think it's kind of cool.
Very extra.
Yeah. But I suppose those moments are meant to be extra, aren't they? It is very on brand.
Although Poppy is not genetically a Time Lord, so they were always human.
Yeah. So no link to Susan there, which is The one thing I didn't understand.
What season isn't a Time Lord?
Well, it was never specific whether she was or not. She was always.
They said that there's a.
Yeah.
Listen, I don't know the deep lore.
I know where you're going.
Any of
that's,
the lore.
That's fine. Go with
I'm
this.
Just saying.
Yes.
I thought that she was just a human and she lived with the doctor in the weird junkyard. And I thought that they said that all the Time Lords are sterile, so they can't reproduce anyway. And maybe she's a bit Time Lordy because she's like been on so many adventures in the TARDIS and stuff. Kind of like how
Are you trying to force the nerd out of me? But
who's the Karen Gillian?
Oh yeah, Amy.
Amy Pond. Amy. Kind of like how Amy Pond had River, but River's kind of Time Lordy because she was quote unquote made in the TARDIS.
The Big Bang.
That's so disgusting.
But it's literally one of the things Moffat said is why I called it that.
That's gross.
I know. You
don't need to say it out loud.
I know, but I just thought, you know.
We know what the implication is. You don't need to say it out loud.
But apparently you need to take it, yeah.
You know, it's almost like time lordiness by proximity.
Yeah.
And not genetic.
I thought it was going to go that way for that reason, because the Susan has never been in the TV show. Clarified.
She's time lordy by proximity, not by genetics.
As far as the TV shows, audio plays have suggested otherwise. There's an assumption that she's a Time Lady of some sort, just, I suppose, because she's called Granddaughter. But you're right, there's nothing
which is... Presumably, if she was a Time Lady, she'd be around more.
Well,
she'd be more present.
This is...
Or is she dead?
What I was actually going to ask you... Well, we don't... Well, I mean, all the Time Lords are meant to be dead. So, assumingly, she's meant to be dead. What I wasn't sure about, and this is where it gets nerdy, and I was about to ask you this... Was this argument that the sterility had come after the most recent killing of all the Time Lords and since then had been sterility? Or were they suggesting that there had always been sterility, which this is where it gets nerdy, sorry. In the 1990s, there was a series of books that were officially authorised by the BBC, but made by Virgin. And some of the writers on that had worked on the TV show. And there was one book called Lung Barrow, which was written by one of the writers of the last season of Doctor Who. And it argued in that the Time Lords were sterile, that they'd been cursed by the Sisters of Pythia, I think, to sterility,
mm-hmm.
and they couldn't have children. So what they did is that they genetically loomed people into existence through a genetic bank of data. So you'd be born in batches of cousins, essentially. And you were all cousins, and it would mean all Time Lords didn't have a belly button because there was no umbilical cord. And that was the notion. The argument at the time in the 90s was that this is why
there are no more.
You don't see children on the Gallifrey or anything, is because there's never, you know, for hundreds of years there's been sterility. Mm. And then there's a very convoluted argument about how Susan is someone from an ancient Time Lord society who... knew a previous incarnation, not regeneration, incarnation of the Doctor, who had been fed into the genetic bank that eventually created this Doctor. Like I said, very confusing. But when I watched that, I was like, is that relating back to this idea from Lung Barrow that they are sterile and always have been? I think at the end of Lung Barrow, the sterility is lifted, which was meant to make sense for the Paul McGann movie, where he was a little more of a frisky Time Lord than had ever been seen before, with the first kiss with a companion. But it just seemed odd that they were echoing this whole thing of sterility. So, yeah, I'm not sure.
It was like a genetic explosion, and it was Omega's fault. Is that not what they were saying?
Yeah. But, I mean, the TV show since 2005 has kind of suggested that he had children. I mean, we've seen episodes where he's talked about
being a parent. Wasn't there the Doctor's daughter?
Well, there's that one, which is slightly different.
Why is that different? I remember watching it.
Because she's not taken from his blood and cloned and genetically created. But similar
to your Time Lord.
I think partially, yes, because she kind of regenerates at the end of that episode.
Did she?
Yeah. Mm. She was meant to die, and then I think Stephen Moffat said to Davis, don't kill that character off, it's great. let's have her slightly regenerate and go off into space, and then we never hear from her again. And then she goes and marries David Tennant in real life. And
yeah, I know that part. That's,
well, I was just making conversation. Don't take that as an assumption on your knowledge or lack of knowledge.
It's just about your detent.
Absolutely. That's great. So, yeah, I don't know. I didn't quite understand that history there that was being given.
Is it because it's incoherent and messy?
It does feel like it's incoherent and messy, which the show, this story explicitly says is, yeah, that's kind of what it's like travelling in Doctor Who time travel, is that it is messy and incoherent because you're going through multiple slightly differing realities. Eras, yeah. So I assumed that would mean that, yeah, maybe in one version, the Lungbarrow books version of events was true, and then there's a slight shift to the left, and they've always been procreating like humans or bunnies. And maybe then there's a shift to the right again, and they are sterile again.
But it doesn't sound like the Rani's plan was to lift sterility. It sounded like her plan was to use genetic data to create.
But the backstory was still oddly about the sterility of the Time Lords, which was
a problem because you can't make more Time Lords. But
yeah, but there were no more Time Lords. Really.
Yeah, but if the...
But it meant that the Rani and the Doctor couldn't. I think that was the point there, wasn't it? Was to get away from the argument, well, why couldn't you use your bank?
Yeah, but you can't make a whole species out of two people.
But you can make it out of one, I suppose, super Time Lord.
Well, I just mean, like she said, oh, I think they're suggesting we mate. If they mated and had a child, that doesn't really help them at all. If you use genetic data a god and then scientifically make lots and lots of
people. But was the argument that the genetic data of that person would have been prior to whatever caused sterility?
They said he's the first Time Lord.
Yeah.
So he made all the other Time Lords. So presumably his DNA is like proto-DNA.
It's hard to say, since there's been, as this show does, so many rewrites. Because, I mean, at one point he was just the Time Lord who piloted a time thing into a black hole, which created the first time travel experiment. But by doing so, he gets locked within that antimatter universe behind a black hole. The story and narrative has shifted over the years, I think, depending.
It remains British and evil.
British and evil, of course, because that's what we are. It's very telling, having just finished watching the two seasons of Andor, just how bad the British are. And brilliantly bad through that show in a way which it resonates possibly with the stuff British have done. But yeah, so yeah, he was very British in those ones. So yeah, I'm not sure. That to me wasn't very clear. I think also because I think you've got multiple writers who have destroyed the Time Lords now. At the end of Jodie Whittaker's era, there was a suggestion the Master destroys all the Time Lords. But they were already extinct, and then they were brought back at the end of Moffat's era, and then they kind of disappeared. They'd been locked away. Well, in the 50th anniversary, you find that moment had been locked away in a painting, I think, that were the last moments of the Time Lords.
It's all very silly.
And they came back, but then they were missing.
No baby Time Lords.
But then even there, in that episode, you saw young Time Lords.
Did you?
In that 50th episode, there was young Time Lords, which was unusual at the time because I was watching that and going, but Lungbarrow said that there would be no young Time Lords, and now you've evidenced that there are Time Lords.
I think them being sterile makes sense.
I like
it. For being that are outside of space and time.
But this is it. This is what I
like. Much kind of like Q's.
Yeah. Well, I liked Lungbarrow because it added to their alienness, and they all lived in living chapter houses. When I say houses, so there'd be these massive, made of wood, spindly wood, and very sort of, I don't know, Tolkienist sort of sense of moving furniture. And they would live in the cousins would live in these houses, and the Doctor's house was the house of Lungbarrow. And it was all just felt more alien rather than human. As soon as you start having children and grandchildren, it starts to feel like you're less an advanced race.
And also, isn't it a bit pointless if you don't really die. You just regenerate.
Well, again, it comes down to what point in the show, you know, by Tom Baker's Doctor, you got the whole idea of there being 13 regenerations and then you're dead and then that's it. And then that more recently has gone out the window because it's obviously very limiting for a show which has gone on beyond 13 characters. But
anyway,
yeah.
So the baby's now 100% human.
Yeah.
So not the Doctor's.
Yeah.
So the point of his regeneration pointless?
I suppose.
I mean, the child is alive.
Exists.
But yeah. Why?
I suppose the idea is that he's willing to sacrifice his life for one being.
Mm.
Or you could argue maybe he didn't know it was going to be 100% human. I think there was a sense of
that's what I mean. Mm. It's worth it to shift it for something that's genetically his, perhaps.
I think that was his hope.
Because lots of humans frequently die.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
In the Doctor's misadventures.
Yeah. Yeah.
So frequently.
Absolutely. Oh, there's definitely a hierarchy of value with the Doctor. I'm saying I'm sorry, as he often does, doesn't really sort of counter that.
Mm.
But yeah, it felt an odd ending. I don't know. It almost felt like an ending I'd imagine in a book rather than a TV show.
I think it was a good episode. I think it was a good ending of an era. But I feel sorry for Belinda's character. And also just, I think, seeing him running around UNIT and him and Belinda being like, oh, now we're going to go to Neptune. And Ruby's just standing there.
And it's like, oh, I'll take you home on the way.
Yeah, because you're not a part of us now.
Yeah, I've moved on.
Yeah.
Moved on. And, you know, I've now got another girlfriend, essentially.
She had my baby, so she's my favourite. Yeah.
And I did feel like either the director or the actress.
And also, really, now it's not my baby, so I gotta go.
Yeah, it was... and then... Yeah... Yeah, it was weird. I mean, I suppose Millie did get the send off with adopting, but then she's at UNIT when he goes into the TARDIS and vanishes and does the whole end bit, and it feels a bit odd. There is that he sort of says, "I've got to go and do this thing," and her story just kind of, yeah, she's like, "This has been a very weird out for me. I feel like I'm not really meant to be here, as if I'm just
superfluous. I served my purpose, which was to, you know, stop Conrad, retrieve the wish baby, like key.
Yeah.
Belinda stayed in a box.
Yeah.
For the baby that wasn't initially real is real now.
I did one small bit I did like was the folding of the of Poppy's.
I thought that was a really, really well played.
Yeah.
But to me initially it read like, okay, so neither of them actually want the baby.
Yeah, I thought about
neither
that.
Neither of them really want her. Yeah. And I thought that was sad. And I thought it was quite purposeful that Ruby was watching this as a child that had been abandoned.
Mm.
I thought that kind of meant maybe she would take Poppy.
Yeah.
But no, it's the process of them forgetting. I think that was well played.
There was a couple of thoughts of our, or I'd speculations that had come out. That one, that when the cloaked figure that Ruby saw at the church was actually going to be the Rani, because she has a very similar cloak.
That would have been cool.
And that would have been somehow to set up the journey.
That would have been cool.
I think that would have been quite nice as well. And it would have been a nice tie to the whole thing, because felt like the Rani was engineering so much.
Yeah. I think that would have been cool. I am sad that we won't get that version of the Rani again.
Yes, same here. And there was another room. Oh, yes, in the giggle.
Mm.
Where the toy maker says he has one of his tooth, the gold tooth, is the master that he had.
Mm.
And then there's a hand that takes the tooth at the end, when the toy maker's been destroyed, there's a tooth left on the deck, and we see a hand come in, a hand with red. Well, people were speculating this again was the Rani, because again it was red fingernails like the new Rani had, and whether there was there, which again I would have overburdened the episode, but so there's a few speculations which didn't happen. But yeah, I think it was fun. I think it was digestible Saturday television for audiences. It's played in cinemas as well, with the first part and the second part. They did that today, which people have gone to. And I think in an era where life for a lot of people is quite difficult and stressful, it's been quite a fun.
It has been joyful.
Yeah, and that's kind of been the focus.
Appreciate.
Yeah. So, well, that's. I think we've covered virtually everything in that episode. We've gone longer than I anticipated, and you seem distinctly a little less prickly than you did before.
I just feel like for an era and two seasons that have been particularly diverse and, I don't know, queer-friendly, female-friendly, they done women dirty.
Yeah, I there's some good arguments for that as well.
Mm.
Yeah, no, I could. Which is funny because you say there's so many women in the room, and yet that still is very much pivoting around that one one person. Yeah,
and they're all sort of discarded.
Especially. I think that's kind of what I didn't like about that sort of end act, is it felt like there was an awareness that there was all these people that had been introduced, but there wasn't the time or maybe even the relevance or interest to really focus on how they resolve in the story, and they are left sort of standing, worshipping, adoring the main character rather than actually having any sort of sense of motivation or... If just one of them was just like, you know, isn't it, are we meant to clock off by this point? And it's, you know, is the things getting on? I don't know. It just something a little different than this worshipping of this one person who just brings problems and terror whenever he appears.
I mean, this is a pro doctor podcast.
Yeah, so absolutely.
I think. The other thing I was going to say is, it's pretty grim for Belinda that she enters the Doctor Who universe because her ex-boyfriend, in an effort to, I don't know, control her, fuck around with the lives of others, names a planet after her. And then her exit from the Doctor's, like, universe is because her and the Doctor make believe that they had a baby, and the Doctor kind of forced that reality back, and now she's always had a baby
and always will have a baby
meanwhile
he's off.
Yeah.
It has a lot of the almost classic male hero tropes there.
Absentee father.
The absentee father, yeah. The best type. You know, the 80s were full of them. We've sorted out the problem. It's great. We've been, you know, I was almost becoming a father to your son, to this woman, to the woman of the episode, but now I've got to head off.
I'm thinking of Quantum Leap.
I'm in Quantum Leap. I'm thinking of Knight Rider, A-Team. All of them do that sort of game of setting up a point where the hero becomes almost like a surrogate father, or sometimes a father, but then for some reason or another is able to exit that, normally because there's a narrative which allows them to. Yeah, there's a higher calling. I mean, The Fugitive was the most famous for it, which I've always found fascinating, because to me that is the epitome of the male dream, you know, where you are...
Fuck around, don't find out.
You are a man who has been wrongfully accused of the murder of your wife, and you're on the run while they try to chase you. So you go from story to story where you can meet people and have adventures and romances, but ultimately you are the person who is being aggrieved here because your wife has been killed and you've been blamed for it. You know, we don't care about what the wife's feelings on this. I am the one being aggrieved here. I can't stay. I must go because I am being unfairly, hunted by the justice. I
need to head off. In that scenario, you do need to be on the move.
Well, that's exactly it. The scenario is nicely embedded as that male fantasy where they can sort of enjoy those moments but not have to have the repercussions, you know, and move on.
Fuck around, don't find out.
Yeah, and that has often been in a lot of shows, and obviously the Doctor's not really that, but there's a sort of taste of that there. But yeah, it always used to make me laugh.
I did appreciate the number of kilts this season brought us.
Yes,
I thought they were glorious.
I like the way they glossed over the fact that he just had a kilt variant of his 50s outfit.
That's cool.
Which was fine. It was a real nice mark of defiance, especially to an era, as shown in the last episode, where the 50s, you know, was not too kind against that sort of nonconformity. It was a really nice visual light, yeah.
I think he wasn't really kind to anyone.
I thought this was a pro-Doctor podcast.
Largely pro. I'm sad we don't get the Rani anymore.
Oh, she might come back.
Well, it's the lesser Rani.
The lesser Rani might come back.
Like an ill-timed Mary Poppins.
Yeah, Mrs. Flood was very much like an ill-timed Mary Poppins. But yeah, we'll just have to see where the next era takes it. And, you know, I don't know what the plans will be. I suppose it'll depend on Disney, it'll depend on the production company, Bad Wolf, what they do as well, and who runs it, to what sort of style or feel, if it does return, it will play. But yeah, I think that was kind of a ballsy surprise ending to an interesting era. And I think with that, unless you have anything to add. No, Magnus has got nothing more to add. I think our time is done. Thanks for listening to this little debate. It's been actually nice to do this in person, where, you know, you can naturally interact.
Don't get used to it.
So speak to you again, probably as usual, by myself in a room.
At Christmas.
At Christmas, yeah.
Fare thee well, listener.